This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross has another week of vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. Recent war films such as Glory, Henry V, and Born on the 4th of July take us to battlefields, and we hear the sounds and get a vicarious semblance of the battlefield experience. Military historian John Keegan took the soldier's approach to writing military history in his highly regarded The Face of Battle, the story of foot soldiers at the battles of Agincourt, Waterloo, and the Somme. Another history, Mask of Command, dealt with the styles of leaders, Alexander the Great, Ulysses Grant, the Duke of Wellington, and Hitler, to illustrate the increasing distance that leaders keep from the front lines. His latest book is called simply The Second World War. Keegan taught at the Royal Military Academy in Sandhurst, England from 1960 to 1986. He's now the defense correspondent of the Daily Telegraph in London. He also co-wrote the current PBS television series called Soldiers. Keegan writes in his foreword that he hopes to bring some sense of order to the chaos and tragedy of the largest single event in human history, a war fought on 6 continents and in 7 oceans that killed over 50 million human beings, left hundreds of millions of others wounded physically and mentally, and devastated much of the heartland of civilization. I asked John Keegan what motivated him to write this particular history of World War II.
I grew up in the Second World War, and it had an extremely formative effect on me. I grew up in the part of England where the Americans came to gather for the great invasion of D-Day, and one saw them coming for probably 2 years, and then suddenly one day they all went. That was D-Day, and it made a tremendously strong impression on me. Then I became a professional military historian, and I taught the history of the Second World War to cadets at Sandhurst, which is the British West Point. I worked out eventually, I taught the course 85 times, so I did know it pretty well. I had a lot to say about it, and when the 50th anniversary came round, when I saw it coming up, I thought I'd better get down what I felt and knew.
One of the substantial differences of histories in the past few years is the knowledge of how much intelligence the Western side actually had, particularly through the Enigma and Ultra machines, which really changed, I think, the interpretation of the course of events of the war. I wonder how that changed your thinking.
Well, I, of course, knew about Ultra when I came to write, because the secret, you'll remember, was divulged in 1973, and since then, all histories of the Second World War have had to be revised in the knowledge that the British were able to break a great deal of the German radio traffic, not all of it. Some held out right to the end, and the Americans were able to read the Japanese diplomatic and naval traffic. And both the Germans and the Japanese remained unaware of that. That, of course, makes our understanding of the war quite different. We mustn't be too complacent. The Germans, particularly the German Navy, had an extremely efficient cipher-breaking organization of its own, and for a long period of the Battle of the Atlantic, the Germans were reading the British naval code and sinking an awful lot of Allied ships as a result.
How did the awareness of the developments of intelligence gathering change your sense then in 1973? Were you startled by this? Did it make you go back to your books? And
I came to it very slowly because I was not particularly interested in the higher strategy of the war at that stage. But of course, as soon as I became conscious of how important it was, I read everything I could on the subject. And now I have quite different perception of how the war worked. Of course, as somebody said, reading a man's correspondence is not the same thing as reading his mind. And so both the British and the Americans, they failed to see things that were going to happen, even though they could read the signals that their enemies were exchanging.
You raise an interesting point about reading the soldier's mind or the enemy's mind. Your books, including The Face of Battle, have studied the attitudes, the mindset, the social conditions, the quality of sound of the battlefields of Agincourt, Waterloo, and the Somme. And I'm wondering how you managed to sort of imbue yourself into those soldiers' minds.
My father had been in the First World War, and curiously, he'd talk about it. A lot of people who were in the First World War wouldn't. He did, and I think that made it... I was very conscious from early in my life of the state of mind of people who are frightened and tired and that sort of thing. And I spent most of my teens in hospital. I was had a long drawn out illness as a adolescent in a ward full of young men who'd come back from the Second World War, and so for a couple of years I listened to their stories of being soldiers, and I think it was very much that I was aware from long before I became a military historian of the state of mind of people on battlefields.
How would you, for instance, research the state of mind of somebody at Agincourt? There's, of course, Shakespeare's account in Henry V.
Yes, there are three chronicles written by priests who were at Agincourt. They don't, of course, talk about the state of mind of the soldiers, but they do give one a very clear impression of the events. And to some extent, you can recreate the physical conditions of the battle. The battlefield is exactly as it was 500 years ago, nearly 600 years ago. It hasn't changed at all. You know how fast horses moved. You know how much armor weighed. You know what an arrow could do to a horse, to a man, to an armored knight. I think it was by working from given facts that one was able to extrapolate.
This was actually kind of a novel angle for a historian to take. I don't think anybody had taken the point of view of a soldier at these battles.
No, of course there was the great American war historian S.L.A. Marshall. He'd done that for the Second World War. I don't think it had been done for battles from long in the past. I couldn't understand why. It seemed such an obvious thing to do. I didn't think I was doing anything particularly original. I was just doing something that somebody hadn't done before, if there's a distinction between being original and doing something for the first time.
Was part of the reason you would take these approaches an idea of trying to convey to the students at Sandhurst what they might expect in battle?
No, not really. I'd never like to do that because I hadn't been a soldier and I wasn't going to be one. I'm rather lame as a result of this childhood illness. And these were young men who were going to go off and do something that I would never do. So I didn't... it wasn't for me to tell them because it was all theory on my part, whereas they were going to find out for real. No, it was curiosity of my own.
Do you miss not having been a soldier? Let me actually.
It's a good question. Well, you know what Dr. Johnson said: every man thinks less of himself for not having been a soldier. And I think particularly in Western society, which is highly militant in many ways, that thought is always there. Yeah, I make my living by writing about war, and I'm always conscious of the fact that I haven't been a soldier. Now, I'm physically unfitted to be a soldier, but nevertheless, I can't quell that self-reproach.
My guest is military historian John Keegan. His latest book is The Second World War. You've said that you've not served as a soldier, but you did go see a battlefield in Lebanon. What was your reaction to a war scene?
I saw a lot of battlefields in Lebanon. Very strange. I first of all, thought that it was all unrealistic, that it was... I had a strange sense of detachment, as if I was watching a film. And it was only after several days in Lebanon that I suddenly realized that it was all extremely dangerous. And... once I realized how dangerous it was, I became gripped by a constant fear, which didn't leave me until I left the country.
Were you able to bring any of that sense of feeling then into your own writing or research? Did it give a different perspective to you on
One thing in particular, I spent part of a morning waiting in the middle of a no-man's land where the front lines of several of these militias, Christian militias, Muslim militias, meet, and waiting to see whether they would send delegates to a ceasefire meeting. And we had to stand in no-man's land at a few hundred yards away from the front lines of several of these militias. That was, I think, the moment when I realized how frightening it was. But the impression I got, which I had never grasped before, is how physically disgusting a battlefield is. It's dirty, it's stinking, it's littered with rubbish, garbage, stagnant water. Battlefields are physically revolting places, and I just, that was the new perspective that I got from it. And I've often, by the way, I talked about that afterwards to soldiers, to people who've really been in battle, in fighting, and of course they all agree that it's the physical repulsiveness of ground that is fought over for protracted periods is one of the things that makes war so really repellent to people who have to take part in it.
As a 23-year-old, you received a grant to travel in the United States to visit the battle sites of the Civil War. Which, of course, probably by that time had been grown over with lovely grass, and there were humps where great ditches had probably once been. This then changed forever your sense of what a battlefield might have been?
Oh, yes. I think the National Park Service do a wonderful job, but, of course, they do turn battlefields into parks. They're, as you say, they're beautiful. I mean, if you go to the crater at Richmond... It's a rather charming piece of landscape, and yet in 1864 it was disgusting, it was terrible, it was littered with hundreds, thousands of bodies, the people who've seen that, I think, are marked, scarred by it for the rest of their lives.
I wonder if you could describe the social transformation that went on in military society when barracks came in.
Yes, that was odd. Soldiers had been billeted. They'd either taken lodgings, simply billeted themselves, whether the civil population wanted it or not, or they'd been billeted by billeting officers around the countryside. That was true until the end of the 18th century, when states started to build barracks for their armies. It meant that armies became better behaved. They weren't such a burden to the populations that they lived among. On the other hand, they became instruments, much more effective instruments of repression. And I don't think that the governments of Europe could have put down the revolution of 1848 unless they'd had soldiers in barracks. As you probably know, 1989 is being widely compared to 1848. 1848 was a great year of revolution in Europe when peoples tried to seize their liberty from the Russian Tsar and the Habsburg Emperor of Austria and the Prussian King. And these liberation movements were put down by the national armies, but the national armies were under the authority of the kings as effectively as they were, because they lived in barracks. They were separated from the population. They were, in effect, internal police forces. And I don't think that could have happened without barracks.
One of the issues which you grapple with is that of heroism. And in The Mask of Command and your other books, you talk about the distance that a leader will be from battle. Alexander would plunge in ahead of his men. Hitler, at the other extreme, would stay as far away from the front of his battle, from the battlefront as possible. You then extrapolated this to our nuclear age, and I wonder if you could talk about notions of heroism in our own time.
Well, of course, one of the marvelous things about 1989 to 90 is that we've suddenly don't feel we have to be oppressed by the fear of nuclear war any longer. it's a cloud that's been lifted from us. But it always seemed to me in the years when we were talking about the nuclear shadow that lay over us that there was an appalling credibility gap between populations and their leaders, because one thing was absolutely certain, that the leaders were going to be in the safest position of all if a nuclear war did come about. They would be buried hundreds of feet below ground in air-conditioned, bomb-proof shelters, whereas the people in whose name they were allegedly conducting a nuclear exchange would be exposed to its worst horrors. There is a very great difficulty in persuading people to accept authority, particularly authority in wartime or in crisis, if there's seen to be an enormous credibility risk gap between the leader and the led. It's a theoretical point, has become, it seems to me now, this last few months, completely theoretical, but important nonetheless.
You sound confident about that it has become less critical.
Let's say we've got a few years.
Uh-huh. 50 years ago, there was the secret non-aggression pact between the Soviet Union and Germany in which Russia declared it wanted Latvia and Estonia, wanted a free hand in Finland, and also wanted the province of Romania. And in the past few weeks, we've seen vast changes. What is your perspective on this as a historian, if you can give sort of an instant analysis?
It was the most extraordinarily cynical deal that two statesmen have ever pulled off, I should think. They simply sat down in the middle of August 1939 and carved up Eastern Europe between them, said, you have this, we'll have that, and as for the wishes of the people concerned, absolutely no consideration whatsoever. Hitler and Stalin agreed to chop Poland in half. Stalin was to have, as you say, the Baltic states, whatever he wanted to do in Eastern Finland, parts of Romania, parts of Czechoslovakia. It was all to go to him, and the quid pro quo was that Hitler could do what he liked west of the agreed line, and he proceeded to do so, of course. It was in this wonderful time when we see the burden of tyranny lifting from the Eastern European peoples, it's almost incredible to look back and think how cynical it was. It was more cynical than the sort of deals that 18th century kings did.
In many ways, it seems that as leaders have gotten farther and farther from the field of battle and the populace actually on the front line, that here now the populace is on the front line in Eastern Europe and they have managed to sort of twist things around and told the leaders what they want.
Well, of course, we do have to take account of the fact that Russia's attempt to make itself a superpower economically broke it. Gorbachev, no doubt, is a man of sweetness and light, but it's military overspending that's made him that. I don't think if the Russians had pursued a more rational military policy, I don't think we'd see Gorbachev behaving in the way that he is.
The role of terrorism in our time seems to be to have changed sort of a concept of warfare. Sometimes it seems there's like a low-grade infection of war going on all the time. No longer the massed forces, the giant fighting machines, except in rare conflicts. How do you see this as changing the face of warfare?
Well, I think the terrorists have been having an easy ride in the years of the superpower confrontation. I think they won't have such an easy ride from now on. Terrorism flourishes when, in the space left by the hostility of much larger enemies, the large enemies are now settling their differences. And I think one of the things that they'll agree on is that they won't tolerate the level of terrorism that we've seen in the world. I think I think this is, we're beginning to see this in your efforts to put down large-scale drug trafficking in Central America. 10, 15 years ago, I think the Russians would have seen an opportunity to make difficulties for America there. Now it's not in their interest to make difficulties for America, and that weakens the ability of the terrorists to operate freely.
Some have said that nowadays the United States needs a new enemy now that the Cold War seems to have evaporated, and take on something else other than the Soviet Union, perhaps a larger issue like dealing with the environment. What happens to a country that doesn't have an active enemy?
Well, I think that's a profoundly philosophical question. It depends whether you think that some external challenge is necessary for a state, for a people to operate at a high level of energy, or whether you think that, in fact, they can satisfy themselves, they can find their psychic satisfaction in purely peaceful activities. I don't like the idea that it's necessary to have some overt or covert aggression, as it were, hostile challenge for a society to operate in. I'd prefer to think that it will be possible for people to flourish through the arts of peace rather than through the arts of war.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
John Keegan's new book is The Second World War. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.